Pardon me. What do you think about drug abuse?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly against it. I mean, all that smoke and LSD and shoot marijuana.
Marijuana is smoked and LSD is taken orally.
Yes.
Yeah, by the way, there are a few other differences between marijuana and LSD.
Well, I'm against it. That's all I know.
You know, I think you're right.
What's that?
That is all you know. There's a lot of talk these days about drugs, a lot of misinformation going around. Why not get some facts for a change? Right now, your American Red Cross is offering a pamphlet called Drugs and Their Abuse. It's factual and straightforward. The pamphlet includes instructions on first aid for victims of drug overdoses, as well as a description of the various kinds of drugs and their effects. For a copy of Drugs and Their Abuse, contact your local Red Cross chapter. Someone you love may be glad you did.
You mean they really smoke that stuff?
What do you think about drug abuse?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly against it. I mean, all that smoke and LSD.
LSD is taken orally.
Yeah, well, I'm against it. That's all I know.
It's not enough to be against drug abuse. Why not get some facts? Right now, your American Red Cross is offering a pamphlet called Drugs and Their Abuse. It's factual and straightforward. For a copy, contact your local Red Cross chapter. Someone you love may be glad you did.
Hey, are you sure they don't smoke it?
Last year, the American Red Cross spent over $56 million on service to members of the military, veterans, and their families. More than $32 million on disaster victims. In excess of $15 million on the Red Cross Blood Program, over $3 million on the nursing program, and more than $6 million on community health and safety programs. And made one disaster victim stop crying. It was a very good year. Help us have more. Support your Red Cross the United Way. It's high noon. Two men stand facing each other. The moment of truth had come.
Well, the moment of truth has come.
Yeah, the other guy just said that.
Oh, I'm sorry. This town ain't big enough for the two of us.
Yeah, well, on the count of three, we'll draw. One, two...
Hold it, boys.
Twice. Sheriff.
Boys, I just happened to overhear your argument about the town not being big enough for the two of you.
Yeah.
Why, there are many fine homes here in town. Your only problem is selecting the proper one and doing it wisely. That's where I can help you. What you should read before buying a home is a copy of FHA's Consumer Bulletin on Home Financing. It tells you how much your loan is going to cost you, how long it'll take to repay. For FHA's booklet, simply write Department of Housing and Urban Development, Washington, D.C., zip code 20410.
Hey, how about that? A sheriff reading a commercial.
Oh, you got me writing my FHA booklet.
That wasn't no commercial. That was a public service announcement.
Yeah, and I ain't no sheriff either. I'm an actor, so there.
Oh! Oh.
Some people save money by doing it themselves, but there are other ways to save money. If you're thinking about buying a home, be sure to get the free FHA Consumer Bulletin on Home Financing. Send a postcard to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Washington, D.C. Zip code 20410.
Would you write the card for me, Mac? I think I hurt myself.
Do you really enjoy this camping out?
This is where we live. We can't afford a home loan.
Why don't you get FHA's free consumer bulletin on home financing? Write to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Washington, D.C., zip code 20410.
Oh, where's that boy of mine? Oh, there he is up in that tree. We've just got to get out of these woods. Yeah, what do you want?
Need any improvements on your home, sir?
No.
I think you do now. Why not write for the free FHA Consumer Bulletin on Home Improvement? Send a postcard to Department of Housing and Urban Development, Washington, D.C., zip code 20410.
Gee, thanks, pal.
Sir, sir, would you get my shoe out of your door, please? I'll never be able to afford a new house. By the time I pay my bills, all I have left is 4 cents.
That's all it takes. A 4 cent postcard will get you a copy of FHA's Consumer Bulletin on Home Financing. Just send it to Department of Housing and Urban Development, Washington, D.C., zip code 20410.
You really know how to hurt a guy. My last 4 cents.
Huntsville, Alabama, and Saturn V, the giant rocket for Apollo 11's moon landing mission. That's the story, the highlights in a moment as NASA presents the space story.
The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Soon, Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong, Mike Collins, and Buzz Aldrin are to embark on perhaps man's greatest journey. The assignment is clear. With Collins remaining behind in lunar orbit, Armstrong and Aldrin are to land on the surface of the moon, explore it, return to join their companion, and all three return safely to Earth. 20 manned space flights have preceded this lunar landing mission, the latest being Apollo 10, which carried astronauts to within 8 miles of the moon's surface. Apollo 10 was the final dress rehearsal. Apollo 11 will be opening night. The people, companies, and pieces of equipment which have contributed to the lunar landing mission number in the thousands, even hundreds of thousands. A vital part of the Apollo story was conceived and became a reality at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. This was the birthplace of the Saturn rocket. Saturn V, latest in an evolution of Saturn vehicles, will lift Apollo 11 off the Earth and propel it toward its lunar landing objective. This mammoth 30-story powerhouse is capable of lifting over 6 million pounds off the launch pad. Director of the Marshall Center is Dr. Wernher von Braun. We ask him to discuss Saturn's role during the upcoming flight in comparison with the most recent Apollo 10 moon orbital mission.
The mission is very similar as far as Saturn V is concerned as the mission successfully flown in Apollo 10. The only difference, as you will remember, between Apollo 10 and the forthcoming Apollo 11 mission is that in Apollo 10, the LEM did not descend all the way to the lunar surface, but interrupted the sequence of events short of the lunar landing itself. For the Saturn V, this doesn't make any difference.
Dr. Wernher von Braun. At the Marshall Space Flight Center, Deputy Manager of the Saturn V program is Roy Godfrey. He discussed for us the rocket's readiness for Apollo 11 based on past performance.
The performance of the launch vehicle in putting the spacecraft into translunar trajectory was actually better in the most recent flight than we've ever had before. The all flight systems have been reviewed in our flight evaluation process to be sure there were no anomalies which needed to be corrected before we fly the next mission. And as of this time, we have seen nothing of consequence to, or nothing which would require corrective action.
We ask Roy Godfrey to describe the monitoring and checkout process which will take place for Saturn V during the final hours of the Apollo 11 countdown.
Each major system is monitored by several what we call red line measurements or other indications of its performance. All the what we call critical components are monitored to be sure they're operating correctly. We have extensive readings directly in the blockhouse. In addition to that, the flight telemetry system looks at several hundred measurements throughout the launch vehicle. These are continuously monitored on the ground before launch, and if we see any indications of a problem there, of course, we will call a hold and resolve the problem before we proceed.
Deputy Program Manager Roy Godfrey and comments on vital Earth-to-space transportation for the moon landing crew of Apollo 11. The Saturn V rocket story from NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, Huntsville, Alabama.
This has been the Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report. Brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Kennedy Ludlam with Willard Scott reporting.
Washington, D.C. plans for a new mode of space transportation, a reusable space shuttle system, which may be operational by the end of this decade. That's the story Willard Scott reporting. Details coming up. This is the Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It's an airplane-like vehicle with wings, about the size of one of today's three-engine commercial jet transports. It's to fly into space like a rocket, conduct missions in Earth orbit like a spacecraft, and return home to a ground landing like an airplane. Then, after a brief refurbishment, it'll be ready for another flight. In brief, that's the description of the reusable space shuttle,
presently planned for operations in space by the end of this decade. Today's launch technology requires a new rocket and a new spacecraft for every mission, manned or unmanned. A reusable shuttle system capable of flying over and over again, up to 100 times, may eventually completely replace our stable of expendable rockets, and ultimately reduce the cost of placing payloads into orbit by as much as 80%. In Washington recently, we talked with NASA's director of the reusable shuttle program, Charles J. Donlan.
Well, a big advantage of the shuttle is in this reusable feature, the ability to launch at lower cost. It's very attractive to be able to do this. But by far, we feel the greatest economies that the shuttle will effect in our space program is in the payload area, because we will be able to not only launch the payloads into orbit, but to retrieve them, recapture them, bring them back to Earth, and refurbish them and reuse them again.
Mr. Donlan continued that shuttles are to be flown into space by crews of from 2 to 4 men. And although the shuttle falls under the cognizance of the nation's manned spaceflight activities, the primary assignment will be to carry unmanned spacecraft into orbit.
The use of the shuttle has been somewhat confused by comparisons with the existing stable of launch vehicles. And while we have said that the space program of the future will involve communication satellites, weather satellites, it has not always been obvious that what we have in mind is launching those payloads with the shuttle. And the shuttle will replace all of the launch vehicles in our stable.
A unique feature of the reusable shuttle will be a large cargo area in which man can be used to check out satellites in space before placing them into their proper orbits. These same satellites can be revisited from time to time by shuttle crews for routine maintenance and repair. If a satellite completely malfunctions, it can physically be retrieved, brought back to Earth by the shuttle, be refurbished or fixed, and taken aloft once more. Additional capabilities of the shuttle will include the possibility of transporting non-astronaut scientists into space to conduct experiments with their own laboratory equipment from within the shuttle's cargo bay. Overall, NASA Shuttle Program Director Charles Donlan summed up his own personal feelings this way.
4 years ago, I wouldn't have thought the shuttle, as we now visualize it, was too attainable from a feasibility point of view. But there have been some very remarkable advances in technology, and as we faced the concept, it became increasingly clear that the shuttle offers an unrivaled opportunity to provide us with a lower-cost transportation, which we think is needed to be able to exploit space for the benefit of the nation and for mankind.
Charles J. Donlan, and comments on plans for transportation of the future in space. The reusable space shuttle. This has been The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Willard Scott speaking. Washington, D.C. Comments on the reusable space shuttle program by NASA's Director of Manned Spaceflight. That's the story Willard Scott reporting. Details coming up. This is The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It's to be fully operational by the end of this decade. A revolutionary, flexible, and cost-reducing round-trip space transportation system quite different from today's methods of launching manned and unmanned vehicles into orbit.
Of course, ever since the space program began, we've been using boosters that are called ballistic boosters to put payloads or satellites into orbit. And each time they're used, they are destroyed. They re-enter the atmosphere and burn up during the entry into the atmosphere. And so each time we launch a satellite into orbit, we throw away a large ballistic booster. We've been doing that since the programs began, and all the countries in the world have done it this way.
Dale D. Myers is NASA's Director of Manned Spaceflight. In his office in Washington, Mr. Myers spoke with us recently about plans well underway to make a reusable space shuttle system a reality by 1980. The shuttle will consist of two basic components, a booster stage and an orbiter. The booster will have the job of lifting the manned orbiter vehicle to an altitude of about 25 miles. At that point, the two vehicles will separate. The booster will fall back into the ocean, be recovered, and made ready for another mission. The orbiter will continue into space under its own power to conduct a wide variety of possible assignments before returning to a ground landing for refurbishment and reuse also.
The whole idea here is to have a device which can carry a satellite into orbit, place it in orbit, and then re-enter back through the atmosphere and land back on a runway just like an airplane does today. The kind of thing that's involved in the shuttle has been studied, and research has been underway in this area for many, many years, at least 20 that I can remember, because the whole concept of being able to recover these boosters and use them over again means that we don't have that large expenditure of throwing away an expendable booster, and we can reduce the cost of putting various things into orbit. And that reduction in cost, we think, is going to open up a whole new capability for man to operate easily and less expensively in space. And therefore, like any market, it opens up the opportunities for much more useful work to be done in space.
Dale Myers continued that the space shuttle, involving a crew of from 2 to 3 men, will represent a merging of manned and unmanned space activities. Primary assignments will include placing nearly all automated satellites into orbit, aided with the shuttle's roomy cargo bay, and also by the use of man to check out the vehicles before they're released into their proper orbits. These same unmanned vehicles, weather, communications, earth resources, or other scientific satellites, could be periodically revisited by shuttle crewmen for routine maintenance and repair. There's also room for non-astronaut scientists and their equipment inside the shuttle, and the list of potential space missions could go on. In essence, the reusable shuttle system will virtually replace today's stable of expendable rockets and spacecraft at substantially lower cost per mission.
We're looking forward here to an opportunity with the shuttle of actually reducing the cost, not only of launches, but reducing the cost of the satellites that are carried at the same time. So in terms of the taxpayers' view of the space program, we're seeing here the opportunity to keep pressing down the cost of space operations. At the same time, we will be increasing the, let's call it, the amount of space per dollar that we'll get.
Manned Space Flight Director Dale Myers and comments on plans for the reusable space shuttle, an efficient, flexible space workhorse holding the key to the nation's future in space. This has been The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Willard Scott reporting. San Francisco, California. A status report on the nation's present unmanned space mission to the giant planet Jupiter. That's the story. Willard Scott reporting. Details coming up. This is The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So far, only our closer neighbors in the solar system have been explored by manned and unmanned spacecraft, the Moon, Venus, and Mars. 2 months ago, the U.S. successfully embarked on its first mission to one of the outer planets, the largest body in the solar system except for the Sun, of course, Jupiter.
The planet Jupiter is a very fascinating planet for many reasons. One of the striking things is that it has a mass that's about 318 times the mass of the Earth. As a matter of fact, the mass of Jupiter is considerably more than the mass of all the other planets combined.
That's John Foster, Director of Development for NASA's Ames Research Center near San Francisco, California. Ames is responsible for 2 unmanned Pioneer scientific missions to Jupiter. The first, Pioneer 10, was launched this past March 2nd. Many mysteries of Jupiter are to be examined close up by Pioneer 10 a year from this December. Included will be investigations for the spacecraft's 13 experiments of the planet's liquid-like atmosphere, its orange and blue-striped cloud tops, and a huge red spot which appears to change locations in the atmosphere itself. The surface features will also be examined from Pioneer's vantage point, some 87,000 miles from the planet. During Pioneer's two-year journey to Jupiter, the spacecraft will also be kept busy probing unexplored regions of interplanetary space, including the so-called asteroid belt. Again, John Foster.
Now, this is a large collection of rocks, you might say, that are located in orbit between the planet Mars and Jupiter. These range up in size to rocks the size of Texas, which are no small size rocks, down to dust, literally. We have no idea, really, the amount of this material, and the spacecraft has a couple of instruments that will look at these asteroids as we go through. We have high hopes, of course, that we can traverse the asteroid belt without physically encountering any of these rocks, because that could be a real hazard, obviously, to the spacecraft. But that, again, shows one of the reasons why the mission is being flown, because if mankind is ever to venture out past Mars towards Jupiter, he has to know what the chances are of either hitting or not hitting one of these small asteroids.
If all continues on schedule, Pioneer 10 will pass by Jupiter in December of 1973, and from that great distance from Earth, transmit close-up pictures, as well as infrared and ultraviolet data, back to waiting scientists. After passing Jupiter, the spacecraft will become the first man-made object to fly completely out of our solar system, on into the Milky Way galaxy, of which we're a part, and a very small part at that. Meanwhile, a second spacecraft, identical to Pioneer 10, will have also been launched toward Jupiter, and may be aimed to study the planet from a different vantage point, depending on the results from Pioneer 10.
We have an option, really, of how we approach the planet. For example, as we aim towards the planet, we could decide to pass around the equator of Jupiter, or we could decide to pass under the South Pole or over the North Pole. Actually, we have the opportunity also to affect how the spacecraft will act after it passes the planet.
Comments by John Foster and the mission of Pioneer to Jupiter. The story from NASA's Ames Research Center, San Francisco, California. This has been The Space Story, a weekly space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Willard Scott speaking.